This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, we're going to be talking about the new films, Annabelle Creation, The Nut Job 2, Nutty by Nature, Pilgrimage, an inconvenient sequel, and Detroit. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course, the world-famous home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@themovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And you can reach out to me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First piece is not actually a piece of news about movies, but I do want to acknowledge that this show airs in Guam on KUSG, 1350 AM and 93.3 FM. And just wanted to let the people of Guam know, those listening on KUSG, you're in our thoughts, you're in our prayers, and hopefully for you and everybody else that this little show can offer a bit of distraction from all the other crazy stuff that's going on in politics now. Now, moving on to some actual movie news. The piece of news that caught my attention this week was that there was an announcement from Disney that it's going to be pulling all of its titles from Netflix. And as you know, that they occasionally put all the Marvel titles, not like the Netflix series, like the Marvel TV series, but the movies, the Marvel movies and the animated films and Star Wars. They got Rogue One is on Netflix actually right now. They're actually going to move those off of Netflix, and I believe it's in 2019, they want to start their own streaming service channel. And I've been kind of watching this happen. You get streaming services pop up here and there, and there's so many of them. And even if you talk about the big players, you've got Netflix, you've got Amazon Prime, you've got Hulu, you've got Vudu, you've got Epix, you've got a billion other ones that are free. And this is a great time to sort of address the competition that's going on in the marketplace. And what this reminds me of is premium cable back in the 80s. And one of the reasons why this news story kind of jumped out at me is because Disney had the Disney Channel. Now, the Disney Channel still exists, but the Disney Channel is very different than it was back in the 80s. Back in the 80s, when the Disney Channel first showed up, it was a premium service. You had to pay for it. And it was a fee that was commiserate to paying for HBO every month, which isn't bad. And the cable companies would package sometimes them together and be like, you get the full movie package, you can get HBO, Showtime, Cinemax. And of course, then they expanded them. When you get HBO, now you get like three of them. But back in the day, when you got HBO, you had HBO and that was it. You had one channel and you paid for it and you just got uncut movies. The world right now, the entertainment industry is going down that business model, very much like premium service. And with Disney saying, we're going to have our own channel, in order to watch these Disney things, you have to subscribe to the Disney Channel. Back then, back in the 80s, if you wanted Disney, you pretty much are going for the cartoons and the Disney properties. And then sometime in the 90s, I forget when it was, but at some point, Disney finally said, you know, we're going to put this as just a basic cable package, so you don't have to pay a premium. And I think that's when they were moving to doing their own network shows, and they were putting commercials in their programming anyways. And so there are a lot of people that are like, the reason you pay for a premium channel back in the 80s and 90s, early 90s, was that you get it commercial free and you get uncut movies. And that's essentially what they're trying to do with the streaming service. That's at least what it looks like they're trying to do. Here's the problem though. When you start compartmentalizing your content onto different streaming services, you're just going to cut into your audience. Competition is good, but exclusive competition like that can hurt itself. It'd be sort of like, and that's actually used to happen. I remember when I went to school in Bowling Green, for college. And in Toledo, the theaters, there were actual contracts with studios where like certain studio chains weren't allowed to show movies from different studios. So if you wanted to see a movie that was, say, a Paramount movie, you had to go to a certain theater in Toledo, and it wouldn't be anywhere. Whereas I live in Columbus, Ohio. If you want to see a Paramount movie or Disney or Warner Brothers, you know, this week Annabelle Creation is out. You can go to literally any first-run theater in Columbus. Doesn't matter whether it's an AMC or a Cinemark. They're all going to be showing Annabelle Creation. You didn't have exclusivity of runs. Maybe in the smaller theaters, like when there's they have these one or two or three screen theaters in town. But for just the multiplexes, you can go anywhere. Imagine if you could only go see certain movies at certain theaters. You cut your marketplace in half. And that's going to be a problem. And because the way this is working is if you want to watch just general content, you're going to have to pick and choose. Because if you're going to get a subscription to all of these streaming channels, it's going to cost you an arm and a leg. And the reason for having a subscription service is no longer going to be economical for you. I mean, now you can do Netflix and it's, what, $10, $15 a month? And boom, you can watch whatever you want that's on the service, and they keep cycling stuff through. And now everyone's like, we want to do our own exclusive content, which is why Netflix is going so much into debt to do that. But the problem is, I've heard friends of mine who are horror movie fans complain about the horror selection on Netflix because it's kind of lame. Because they're just picking out kind of like low-hanging fruit. Quality selection is kind of hard to find, or it comes on and off the service constantly. I don't think this is a sustainable business model. I think it's going to end up collapsing. Right now, I've got Netflix. I've got an Amazon Prime account. Part of the reason is because I get stuff mailed to me through Amazon Prime. It's just it's worth it for the free shipping. And sort of like the video streaming is sort of an added bonus. But if, say, Warner Brothers decides to do theirs, and if you want to watch just basically the major releases, you either have to subscribe to like five or six different channels, and that's going to cost $50 or $60 a month. And so the whole reason for cutting the cable is gone, or you just cut out entire groups of programming. I think right now the market is still trying to figure out what it wants to be. I would love to have a premium streaming service that I could pay even $25 a month, and I pretty much get to stream everything. You know, $20, $30 a month to pretty much watch whatever you want to watch. But the problem is with Netflix, things are coming on and off the service all the time. Same thing with Amazon, same thing with everything. And the volatility of this is working against the market because people are going to be frustrated because the whole dream of being able to watch what you want to watch when you want to watch it isn't actually coming true because the businesses are getting in the way. Mark my words, this is the beginning of the end for any sort of the streaming services now. If Disney is going to pull off all the Marvel movies, the animated films, and Pixar and Star Wars, that's going to be a problem. And then they're going to be reticent to actually do Netflix series, and then they're going to just run them all through their own station, and that's going to splinter it even worse. At some point, this is all going to have to be refocused. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. First one I want to talk about really quickly is Mother. Opens not too far from now, September 15th. It's directed by Darren Aronofsky.
He's a stranger. We're just going to let him sleep in our house.
Did you know he had a wife?
They've come here to see me.
You're insane.
All I'm trying to do is bring life into this house. Open the door to new people, new ideas.
I'm so sorry.
You give and you give and you give.
It's just never enough.
I'm actually looking forward to this one, mainly because Darren Aronofsky's gotten kind of too big with his movies. I mean, I liked Black Swan, but you know, like Noah, that was just way too big. And I'm looking forward to something that's a little more intimate. I'm looking forward to this one. This looks creepy as all get out. The next one I want to talk about is Breathe, which opens on October 13th.
People paralyzed by polio don't last long.
Can't move anything from the neck down. Can't even breathe for yourself.
How do you live like this?
Yes, you suit.
There must be something I can do.
Get me out of here.
Darling, call Teddy. I've had an idea.
A wheelchair that does his breathing for him.
Are you sure it's safe?
The biggest note about this movie is it's directed by Andy Serkis. Of course, everybody knows who he is, a fabulous motion capture actor, and he's shown up on screen a couple times. He's actually in Captain America Civil War, and you're going to see him in Black Panther, but he's best known for his mocap performances. And I think it's interesting that he's going to just a very basic actors in front of a camera type movie. He's not doing motion capture. This looks okay, though. I mean, it looks better than it sounded when I first heard about it, but it does feel like it's kind of trying to be the theory of everything once again with just a different actor and actress. This is probably going to get some award buzz, but I don't know how far it's going to break out. Anyways, it opens October 13th. That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Glass Castle and The Nut Job 2, Nutty by Nature. Because we can go! Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews. Well, I don't even know if I can say let's jump into the movie reviews because I'm not actually going to review these first two movies. And the reason I'm not going to review these first two movies is because Hollywood didn't want people to see them. Well, let me rephrase that. Hollywood wanted as few critics to see these movies as possible. And this actually dovetails into an issue that I've talked about in the past, and you even heard me address it last week. There's always these movies that they don't screen. And a lot of this comes right after there was a story basically saying that they've done studies and now have decided that the Rotten Tomatoes score affects the movie viewership. That movies with low Rotten Tomatoes scores actually will negatively impact whether or not people go see movies. Now, there's an easy response to this that a lot of people will say. They'll be like, why don't you just make better movies? Why release crap? And there are certain films that are, well, let's just say they're critic-proof. And the reason Rotten Tomatoes scores is singled out, and I actually am part of the Tomato Meter whenever I get around to writing a review and posting it up there, but I am part of the Tomato Meter. And one of the reasons that they single out Rotten Tomatoes is because that's what people go to. I don't know how many people are out there saying, oh, Lou Luminick of the New York Times said XYZ. There's a lot of people that it's easy to say, what's the score on Rotten Tomatoes? What's the score on Flixster, which feeds out of Rotten Tomatoes? And the reason people do that is because it's an easy way of just saying whether or not people liked it. But the Rotten Tomatoes score is not perfect. It doesn't measure passion, which is why a movie like Unstoppable, if you remember that movie, that came out several years ago, it was directed by Tony Scott. It starred Chris Pine and Denzel Washington trying to stop a train. That movie had an insanely high Rotten Tomatoes score, but it was hardly an award film. It was hardly a movie that people loved. Just a lot of people were like, yeah, it was good. You know, that was it. You can get a movie that everybody thinks it's maybe a three and a half star movie out of five. And there has been a narrative, especially this year, where critics are trying to say, and journalists and movie journalists are saying, look how we took down Baywatch. And I say, okay, stop. Because first of all, you don't want that on your shoulders. You don't want movies living or dying because of what you say. Because that is an invitation to stop screening movies, which is what's happening now. But also, I think Baywatch was taken down by the fact that Baywatch was a terrible movie and that nobody asked for, and it didn't kind of hit any sort of nostalgia or classic feel to it. It was poorly done. Chips was the same way. The House was another movie that had no screenings whatsoever. It did not do well, probably not because of the Rotten Tomatoes score, but now it's, of course, gotten out. I don't know how many times I go on the radio and I say, well, this movie wasn't screening. The response is, well, that must suck. And what am I to say? Because generally, when a movie is not screened, there's a reason for it. Case in point, look at this week's movies. The ones that were not screened. And that's the ones I'm talking about really quickly here, which is going to be The Glass Castle, which has, at this very moment, a 47% score on Rotten Tomatoes. It only has 57 reviews up there. And 30 of them are negative as compared to 47, which are positive. That's a bad Rotten Tomatoes score. It seems very clear. Now, that had a little more screenings that screened in some other markets, bigger markets, but they didn't screen it everywhere because Lionsgate was afraid that people were going to find out it's not a good movie. Well, no matter what, once you get about 30, 40 scores, I don't know how many that actually gives you a tomato meter rating, but you can still get a number. The Nut Job, 20% on Rotten Tomatoes, and it has 3 positive reviews, 12 negative reviews. It only has 15 reviews. That score's out there. In just 15 people seeing it, the studios are not controlling the narrative by not screening these movies. So, are people listening to tomato meter scores? Yes and no. There's plenty of movies that do extremely well that have bad scores. The Dark Tower won last weekend and had 18% Rotten Tomato score. Emoji Movie actually did pretty well. And Hollywood's patting itself on the back by saying, oh, we held those reviews. We didn't screen it. It's like, everyone knew that was going to suck, but it was one of those kids movie critic proof thing. Oh, well, they reply and say, oh, well, Smurfs, The Lost Village didn't do well. And I think that has more with the problem with Smurfs isn't a modern movie. It's a throwback to 80s and 90s. And the kids today don't care about the Smurfs. But it was just made for kids today, and it really didn't click into the nostalgia of my generation the way, say, like Lego Movie did. With that said, let's talk really quick about these movies that were not screened. The Glass Castle. Based on the best-selling memoir, this film tells the story of a child of wayward and unconventional parents, who are usually homeless, as she looks back in her life.
You shouldn't be ashamed of us just because we choose a different lifestyle than you. When did you lose your sense of adventure?
Let's go, kids! Adventure on our tails!
He means the bill collectors. And if
the
subway's
flat. The kids are tired of moving to a new town every time you lose a job.
You know, all this running around is only temporary.
My parents are squatting in an abandoned building on the Lower East Side.
Do you honestly tell me that you're happy right now?
Yes, I am.
This is one of those movies that I actually said a low tomatoes meter score usually doesn't matter. Well, this one, it matters because this looks exactly like an award bait movie. When they're saying Academy Award nominee Woody Harrelson's in this movie, Academy Award winner Brie Larson's in this movie, they're pushing for the award bait season. It's coming out at the end of the year. This is clearly trying to be an award film. It's not going to make it. It's got less than 50%. It's probably a little bit weepy, a little bit overdone, a little bit hand-wringy. I'm sure I'll probably get a screener for this. I'm not going to bother to watch this. It's not going to get any sort of awards because it's got zero buzz. The only way you generate buzz is by putting the movie out there. And this one was kind of put out there to like bigger markets. But Lionsgate, and they have the money to do screenings everywhere. They just choose not to. But The Glass Castle didn't get screened, so preemptive suck. Another suck from this side.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about The Nut Job 2, Nutty by Nature. The creatures in the Oakton City Park fight against a mayor who wants to turn it all into an amusement park.
I need your help to take back the park.
This park has everything we need.
Yeah! But the mayor wants to destroy everything.
I got bigger plants and trees.
An amusement park!
They're gonna destroy the park.
That's not good.
Don't you see? We're all animals, and we need to look out for each other.
If we want to stop the mayor and his goons,
it's squirrel season.
It's gonna take everyone.
I was one of those people who actually liked the first Nut Job. I didn't think it was great, but that one came out like in January, and I thought, yeah, for just a January animated film, it was cute. It did what it was supposed to do. This one seems a bit forced. It seems like, well, the first one made some money. Let's try and make some more money. And it's, again, that thing of saying, well, it's a kid's movie. It's like the Emoji Movie. There's no buzz. There was no love critically, really, except for me, for the first movie. Let's hide this from critics and not show it. That's why you only had 15 reviews going into the weekend. Guess what? I'm sure this one sucks. And the problem is that right now, when you've got movies like The Emoji Movie and Despicable Me still floating out there, there's not a whole lot of room for The Nut Job 2. People have allowed their kids to play their Take Me to the Movie card for The Emoji Movie. I don't think this movie's going to do well at all. I don't think anybody cares about this. I don't think people really ask for the sequel. This is going to be one where, like, the Smurfs, when they did the first Smurf movie, there was a novelty to it, and then they thought, oh, franchise. Well, just because one movie does well does not mean that sequels will. And which is why Smurfs 2 and then The Lost Village had this stair-stepping down the train. And that's exactly, I think, what's going to happen with The Nut Job 2. And it's got Katherine Heigl in it. When was the last time she was in a movie that made any money? So this one gets a preemptive suck as well.
It sucks.
That is it for this segment. Let's come back in the next segment and I will talk about actual movies I have actually seen, Annabelle Creation and Pilgrimage.
Open Gangnam Style.
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the movies I have seen. First one being Annabelle Creation. This prequel to the spinoff of the Conjuring films looks at the origin of the evil doll in which manifests a demon targeting a group of girls living in an orphanage.
After Samuel and I lost our daughter,
no!
We prayed to see our girl again. The contact started small. But then she wanted permission to move into the doll. We soon realized it wasn't our daughter. We thought helping the girls could be our penance.
This is our new orphanage.
Wow, it's as big as a castle.
But we ended up giving it just what it wanted.
This is, like I said in the description, it's a prequel to a spinoff. If you recall the Conjuring movies, the first Conjuring movies are just about the Warrens, who were these real-life demonologists back in the 60s and 70s. And they had come across a doll, this apparently haunted doll. And it's a real Annabelle, actually. You know, for if you believe in that sort of thing. I know there's some people out there who poo-poo it all. But, you know, hey, you know, if you believe in that sort of thing. But the actual real Annabelle doll doesn't look anything like this creepy monstrosity that is in these movies. It's kind of like a Raggedy Ann doll. But supposedly, it's somehow tied or linked to an evil spirit. And the Warrens had sort of sequestered it from the world, and which makes a real interesting story. But in this one, it's that Annabelle doll, which I don't know why anyone would want this doll. I mean, I even remember when they did the first Annabelle movie a couple years ago, and which is this is a prequel to that. But in that movie, when they first get the doll, she's like, "Oh, it's a collectible doll, isn't it great?" I'm like, "That's a creepy doll. I don't want that doll anywhere near me." Even trying to, because in The Conjuring, it looked evil because it had already been infected by the demon. But in the first Annabelle movie, it was supposed to be just a doll. It still looked pretty horrifying. But anyways, I like these movies. And I like these movies because it kind of comes from the James Wan level of filmmaking. And I mean, James Wan has done some great stuff. He's done some not so great stuff. And even stuff like Dead Silence. I never really liked Dead Silence. I think that was him kind of getting his feet wet. With horror movies. I mean, Saw, I thought, was a much better movie. But he didn't really kind of come into his own until he was doing Insidious and The Conjuring. And part of the reason those films were so good, and they continue through the Annabelle and Conjuring movies, is because he went 180 degrees out of phase with what was really popular at the time, that being found footage. And you know me, I think found footage is a monstrosity and an abomination on filmmaking overall as a whole, because there's a couple decent ones out there, but the rest are just, I've talked enough about found footage. I don't even want to bring that thing up again. But Wan used slow atmosphere, light and shadow, symbolic imagery in the background, practical effects, and the soundtrack, and not just, you know, the Foley score and everything. He really went old school with what makes a horror movie, as opposed to just running around with a video camera and screaming and acting like an idiot. And this continues that feeling. Now, it's directed by the guy who did Lights Out, which was in itself kind of a neat little movie. That was a great little creepy film. Annabelle Creation kind of plays in that sandbox of expected tropes in a horror movie, in the sense of there's young girls, and you see young girls showing up a lot, even more than young, like, boys in movies. For some reason, girls seem so much vulnerable in horror movies. You go back to movies like The Exorcist is, you know, the prime example, but like Audrey Rose or any of the Conjuring movies, which really seem to aim at the girls more than the boys. That is a very familiar trope. It's got the little girl who was in the Ouija prequel, which was another a movie that was actually better than the first. The first Ouija was just disposable scare girls at slumber party crap. But the second one, Ouija Origin of Evil, which kind of feels the same as this one, that was a much better movie. And this one itself is actually kind of a little more nuanced than the first Annabelle, which I like better than most people did. But it is certainly creepy. It's certainly atmospheric. It uses sound. But the only problem with a movie like this is when you do go see it in a theater, it depends on your audience. I've heard some stories from people that people giggle and chuckle and laugh at scenes that are supposed to be shocking. But if you're not respectful to others, you can kind of ruin the experience. So, you know, be judicious on what crowd you see this with, because even the screening I went to, which was a preview screening, earlier this week, there were some people who were a little rowdier than they probably should have been in a horror movie. And that works for some horror movies. Sometimes you want a little bit more of a raucous audience for a horror movie. But, you know, for something like Evil Dead, but something like this, you need a little more respect. And, I thought it was creepy, not perfect, but it gets really dark at times. It's not overly violent. I was actually asked in an interview when I was reviewing this at one point this week. I was asked if it's a gory film. It's not gory at all. There's really not very much actual on-screen violence. It's mostly eerie creepiness, and that I like seeing that. I don't think you need gore. You don't need blood to scare people. I think blood's too easy to do sometimes because it's a pretty simple effect and it's shocking. But it's much harder to scare somebody with light and shadow. And they do it pretty well with Annabelle Creation. So I'm going to have to say that Annabelle Creation rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Pilgrimage. In 1209, a group of monks in Ireland are charged with bringing a religious relic to Rome, fighting off attacks from both crusaders and pagans.
You will see the safe delivery of our holiest relic to Rome. Go with God.
There is a great war being fought.
Infidels surround us. Heretics conspire within our midst.
You are not blind as to what kind of men these are.
We must retrieve it.
Your work is not yet done.
This is a smaller film. It's opening on demand and in limited theatrical release. One of the things I think is most interesting about this movie is it's got a really good cast. It's got Tom Holland as one of the monks. It's got John Barenthal, who is best known right now. He's going to be doing Punisher, but he was in like Walking Dead and he was in The Accountant last year. So he actually plays a little bit against type, kind of partly in type, but also partly against type. He's a little more wide-eyed and innocent, but also has a dark past. And then Richard Armitage is in this movie. So it's actually got a really good cast, and it's very grim and very straightforward. It's heavily dramatic, taking place in the early part of the 13th century. And it's in Ireland, but it's not the lush green Ireland you're used to seeing. This is a creepier, heavier, dour, dreary, rainy Ireland, where these monks, they have to bring this stone that was used to kill a saint. It's one of their treasured artifacts, and it's them trying to keep control of it and save it from bandits. And it gets really intense, because what people don't realize, Ireland had tribes and pagans and different groups. And it's a contested island now, but it's been a contested island for thousand years or more. And even though this takes place in the Middle Ages, it feels kind of like a Dark Ages movie. I mean, it takes place with, you know, shades of the Crusade, and you got Crusade blowback going on around it, but it feels like a Dark Ages kind of movie because it's just a bunch of people in the woods. But it's effectively done. It's a relatively short movie. It's about an hour and 35 minutes, but it can be intense, especially with the battle sequences. And overall, it's probably more for a history buff, I would say, than just the casual viewer. But Pilgrimage is a neat movie, especially if you're going to watch this movie and you realize that these are all superhero actors. Because you got Spider-Man, you've got the Punisher, you've got the guy from The Hobbit, you know. So it's sort of like where a couple years ago Spotlight was a movie wins the Academy Award, and when you realize it's basically a whole bunch of superhero actors in a movie together. You know, you had Batman, and you had Tony Stark's dad, and you had the Hulk. I mean, it was just everybody was in that movie. But overall, this is a Pilgrimage is a decent movie. It's a little bit off the beaten path, but it's neat for this interesting look at the history in this tiny little sliver of life in semi-occupied Ireland. So I'm going to have to say Pilgrimage kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. When I come back, I'm going to be reviewing the films Detroit and An Inconvenient Sequel, plus talk about the box office and the Home Cinema Roundup. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies, continuing with the kind of new movie reviews. Last week, I was not offered a chance to see Detroit. In fact, as far as I understand, it was not screened anywhere in Ohio, which I found really odd because that's total award bait. That's topical. It's socially relevant. It's directed by Kathryn Bigelow, who won an Oscar for The Hurt Locker. They didn't show it anywhere in Ohio. As far as I understand, it didn't go and nowhere in Ohio. I mean, I guess I could have driven up 3 hours and gone and seen it in Detroit. So I had a chance to go check it out this week. Kathryn Bigelow directs this docudrama about the 1967 Detroit riots and the brutal incident at the Algiers Motel.
Here in Detroit, a city of war, violence continues.
We've made state police and National Guardsmen available.
I'm declaring a public state of emergency.
It's a war zone out there. They're destroying the city.
Police!
I'm just going to assume you're all criminals.
You don't talk about this to anyone ever.
This city has problems. But change is coming.
This is obviously a button-pushy issue, and I wouldn't exactly call it an entertaining movie because it is kind of tough to watch. It's not an action film, even though it has elements of that in there. First of all, in terms of what was really good about this movie, it certainly felt like Kathryn Bigelow's direction, which at times is very fly on the wall, but she also tends to get a little bit verbose in her filmmaking. It tends to go on a little long. That was one of my biggest problems with like Zero Dark 30. That they really could have trimmed that down. And this movie does run probably 45 minutes longer than it should. I think it's running times like 2 hours and 25 minutes. And part of the problem is, I think she was biting off more than she can chew on this movie. Like the credit sequence on its own is sort of these Harlem Renaissance paintings and words on a screen, you know, explaining what's going on. And it goes, and it encompasses the entire thing from the Great Migration all the way up to the 60s. And in maybe like less words than you'd have in your average picture book. And it just plows through it. And you can't do that. You can't give, you know, half a century or more of history and something as complex as a racial situation in America and boil that all down into, you know, just a couple minutes. And then they kind of show how the Detroit riots started, but then go into news footage. And so I think she's trying to give context for the Detroit riots, but you really don't get a sense of what's going on because that whole beginning segment feels very rushed. And then after the Algiers Motel incident, which is the bulk of the movie, you have the ending, which is all the fallout from the incident and not just the riots, but mainly from the incident. And which again, you're talking, they take like 20 minutes to do this. So it feels like this truncated Law and Order episode that's overly simplified, and they take certain liberties and streamline things and merge some storylines. And it just comes off as really goofy and cliched. And it's clear she didn't have a really good wrap up to this movie. And she takes 20, 30 minutes to kind of not really wrap it up very well. But the bulk of the movie, which is the Algiers Motel incident, well, it was this group of Detroit policemen and National Guard units and state police that had all gone to the Algiers Motel because they thought there was a sniper, and there was gunfire. They exchanged gunfire, and then they ended up having a whole bunch of suspects in there, and most of them were black except for a couple white girls, which of course infuriated some of the racial tensions there, obviously. And Detroit police, you know, having worked multiple shifts and under the stress of the situation, kind of went off the deep end, and they terrorized these suspects and brutalized them, and some of them got killed, and it was a really ugly situation. And it's tough to watch because it does kind of take that racism and shove it in your face. And I think that that's an important thing to have in the national discussion, because we're getting a return of the questioning of overreach of police authority and levels of police brutality, mainly because now there are cameras around. Everybody's got a camera on their phone, so people are able to take video. And you didn't have this during the Algiers Motel incident. You had to just go by witnesses, and there's things that happen there that as you watch the movie, you'd be like, well, there's only two people in the room and that person's dead. So nobody except that one guy knows what happens in that room. So there were some liberties that Bigelow takes, and she does lay on the racism really thick at times. I'm not saying that doesn't happen, because look, my family's from Cleveland, and Cleveland's a north city, but there was still plenty of racism in Cleveland growing up when I was growing up and visiting there, and I saw that. But I think that sometimes this is painted with a very broad brush and sometimes really aggressively. So that section in the middle, the Algiers Motel incident, that's harrowing, and it's difficult to watch, and it's striking, and it's definitely a discussion piece. Does run a bit long, but still I think Detroit's a decent movie. I mean, it's a shame they didn't screen it. I would have liked to have reviewed it last week, but I'm going to have to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about An Inconvenient Sequel. Al Gore returns to the spotlight to follow up on his 2006 film about global warming.
This is global warming. This, to me, is the most exciting new development. We're seeing a tremendous amount of positive change. The basis is there, but it's still not enough.
It's crunch time at the climate change conference in Paris.
Still some really tough negotiations going on.
What would it take to shift to renewables?
I'm talking about breaking the impasse. Virtually every nation in the entire world agreed to get to zero greenhouse emissions.
To me, this is a huge missed opportunity, because one of the problems with global warming, and in this particular, this environmental issue and climate change, is it was politicized in the 60s. And it's been politicized over the years. Now, I've seen, like, I watched this movie called Merchants of Doubt, which talked about misinformation in the marketplace. And it kind of presented the global warming issue as being something that kind of emerged in the 90s. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I remember watching Cosmos in the 70s with Carl Sagan, and he was talking about the possibility of global warming back in the 70s. And that's because back then, 25 years before the end of the century, you could make grand predictions by the year 2000, blah, 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 blah. Well, the year 2000 came and went, and things didn't happen the way people predicted, because the only way to get people's attention is to go really crazy gloom and doom. But when that doesn't play out, you hurt your own argument. I think this would have been really interesting if Gore would have gone back and taken a much more sober approach and said, this is the state of where we were in 2006 when I made this last movie. Here's all this evidence to show that things have gotten worse. And he kind of does that, but it's haphazard, and he doesn't show really any data, and he doesn't source any data. It's just a lot of shots of flooding and weather events and kind of him getting worked up in front of a crowd. He left the whole discussion of whether or not global warming was happening to the first movie, but he doesn't even really address it here. This is more about Al Gore making a movie about Al Gore, even more than the first movie was. Now, there's less PowerPoint, and that's a good thing, but this is more about, look at me, I'm Al Gore, and look at how much I care, and look at what I'm doing to save everybody. And it kind of becomes this huge ego piece for Al Gore, And look, that's fine that this is his crusade. And we're talking, he's now 15 years, 16 years from his last turn with politics. So he's kind of presents things differently. He's a little less stiff. He's no longer being a politician. He's very much being an advocate. But the movie is just basically about how awesome Al Gore is and what he's doing to fix the world. I mean, the movie does bring up several things. It brings up the issue in like the Paris climate talks of why India is like, well, why did you guys get to burn fossil fuels for 150 years and build your society? And now that we're ready to do that, we can't. And it does show the growth of certain renewable energy. And I'll tell you, I drove across this country just this summer. We drove from Columbus down to Phoenix. And then we're driving across the lower Great Plains through Oklahoma and Texas and New Mexico and Arizona. And you see these giant wind farms. And we haven't taken this road trip for 10 years. But this time we went down there, you saw lots of wind farms. And I know people will say, well, wind farms are loud and blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of nothing in that drive. So there's a lot of room for wind farms. And they've got wind farms there. And that's great. And I think that the country does need to go to renewable resources for no other reason than to not be dependent on fossil fuels and drilling and foreign fossil fuels. That's a big deal. We can have energy independence in America by ourselves. That's good. So this did show the growth of some of these alternative energies, but it always tends to loop back on how awesome Al Gore is. And yeah, I just kind of felt like I was watching a campaign commercial for him. So I'm going to have to say an inconvenient sequel kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
The box office. Last week, I said $20 million horse race between The Dark Tower and Kidnap. Kidnapped only made about 10, but The Dark Tower came right close to 20. Dunkirk right below it. And then the Emoji movie is actually surprisingly holding on. It made $12 million. This week, it's easy. It's going to be Annabelle. I think it's good for $30 million, which is lower than the first Annabelle, but still not bad for just a horror movie in the summer. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. You've got Snatched, which is that terrible movie with Amy Schumer and Goldie Hawn. The Dinner, which is an interesting contemplative film about affluenza. Then there's Teen Wolf from the 80s with Michael J. Fox and Teen Wolf 2 with Jason Bateman. They got a new Blu-ray release this week, so you can check those out for your 80s nostalgia. That is it. And once again, I'd like to send my concerns out to KUSG and everybody listening on that out in Guam. You're in our hearts and prayers. And I hope you all tune in next week. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.